From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Democracy cannot exist without an informed public, and these mega media companies are not informing us.
Today, Bill Moyers on the battle for the public airwaves at a gathering of 2,000 people, part of a growing media and democracy movement in this country.
We have a government of leak and innuendo and spin, of misnamed public information offices that churn out blizzards of releases filled with self-justifying exaggerations and occasionally just plain damned lies. Censorship without officially appointed censors.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Before we go to Bill Moyers, over 10,000 people gathered this weekend outside the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, to protest the U.S. Army School of the Americas, a combat training school for Latin American officers. It was recently renamed WISC, the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. The protest culminated with a funeral procession to symbolize thousands killed by soldiers trained at the school. The annual demonstration is timed to fall on the anniversary of the murder of six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter in 1989 in El Salvador. They were killed by graduates of the School of the Americas. At the Fort Benning protest this year, more than 30 people were arrested after entering the base in an act of nonviolent civil disobedience. They took this action knowing they could face between 3 and 6 months in federal prison. In years past, the arrests at the SOA have been coordinated with the police. Those wanting to be arrested simply crossed a line and were then escorted to police buses. This year was different. We turn now to Kathy Kelly, founder of Voices in the Wilderness. Democracy Now! Was there when she got arrested. Kathy, can you take it from there? Can you describe what happened?
Well, Amy, after we were brought into a warehouse where the United States military were processing those who were arrested before turning us over to federal marshals, we were taken through a search procedure, and I expected something fairly routine. But there were five soldiers at the station that I was brought up to, two of them screaming at me. And I turned to ask the soldier why she was screaming. I was told, look straight ahead, don't talk, and then subjected to the most rough and aggressive search I've ever experienced. And at one point, it was so rough, I was being womanhandled, I'd say. I decided I couldn't cooperate. I lowered my hands to my side and said quietly, I'm sorry, I can't cooperate with this. I then found myself shoved to the floor. I have a slightly blackened eye for that. And I was hogtied. My wrists were cuffed. My ankles were cuffed. Wrists and ankles then tied together. And five soldiers were squatted around me, one with his or her knee into my back, leaning so heavily that I really couldn't breathe. So I started to moan as best I could. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Please help. And then after several minutes, when I finally was able to articulate that I'd had four lung collapses, that pressure was released. And I was then carried hogtied to the next station and then to the next. And when they brought me to the station where they wanted to fingerprint me, a soldier who had been part of this assault knelt down in front of me and about 3 inches from my nose told me that if I didn't follow every move he instructed me to make so that they could uncuff me and take my fingerprint, I would immediately be pepper sprayed. And then eventually I rejoined the others who were under arrest.
Can you explain what you mean being hogtied?
Well, my wrists were bound together and my ankles were bound, and then my wrists and ankles were tied together, so I was on my belly, and this made it, I suppose, easier for them to carry me face down from one station to the next and then prop me up kneeling to go through the remainder of the process.
Kathy, we have to move on, but I want to ask what you plan to do now, and do you regret having been to the protest in front of Fort Benning?
Oh, no. I urge everyone to not be in the slightest deterred from going to protest and from continuing to advance these efforts to nonviolently resist what's happening in our country. It's a very serious time. And it's good for me to know what's happened to gang kids in my neighborhood under arrest many times. Who knows what's happening in Guantanamo? And we shouldn't be surprised that a base where people are trained for torture would exact these kinds of techniques as they train their own soldiers to deal with U.S. citizens.
Kathy Kelly, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness. Do you know the time you face for your protest?
That's right. 3 to 6 months.
3 to 6 months. You are listening to Democracy Now!, and we will follow the case of Kathy and the other people who were arrested at School of the Americas as we move now from one mass movement to another, the grassroots movement for democracy and media. In November, nearly 2,000 journalists, media activists, others gathered in Madison, Wisconsin for the first ever national conference on media reform. Bill Moyers gave the keynote address on the battle for the public airwaves. This is what he had to say.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I'm flattered to be speaking to a gathering as high-powered as this one that's come together with an objective as compelling as media reform. Even though I tell you that, like some journalists, I'm uncomfortable with the word media, even though the concept is now conventional wisdom. Ted Gupp of Case Western Reserve wrote a wonderful article in the Chronicle of Higher Education a few months ago in which he said that media has come to be mean so much it means nothing. David Broder, he said, is not Matt Drudge. Meet the Press is not Temptation Island, or at least I don't think it is. And I'm not Jerry Springer. I do not speak for him. He does not speak for me. When I saw Oliver North reporting on Fox from Iraq, pushing our troops to tell him, does Fox rock? Does Fox rock? I was reminded that not everyone with a pen, microphone, or camera, or even with a loud voice, are all one and the same, although we're all lumped together under the rubric of media. But I think I am in the spirit of Ernie Kovacs, the comic, who once quipped that television, he knew television was a medium because it was neither rare nor well done. Well, I accept that. I know that I work and all of us live in media land. And God knows we can stand some media reform. I'm sure you know that that's really an incomplete description of the job ahead. Taken alone, those two words suggest that we've assembled a convention of efficiency experts, tightening the bolts and boosting the output of the machinery of public enlightenment, or else a conclave of high-minded do-gooders applauding each other's sermons. But as the sessions today proved, and as those tomorrow will confirm, we need to be, and we will be, much more than that. Because what we're talking about is nothing less than rescuing a democracy that is polarized, in danger of being paralyzed, and could even be pulverized by the mega media giants. Alarming words, I know. But the realities we face should trigger alarm. Free and responsible government by popular consent just can't exist without an informed public. Now, I know that's a cliche, but as Adlai Stevenson said, truisms are true and cliches mean what they say. Democracy cannot exist without an informed public. So it's simply not the cause of journalism that's at stake today. It's the cause of American democracy. It's the cause of American liberty itself. Tom Paine put it this way, "The sun never shined on a cause of greater worth." He was talking, of course, about the revolutionary America in 1776. But that revolution ran in good part on the energies of a rambunctious tiny press. Freedom and freedom of communication were birth twins in the future United States. They grew up together, and neither has fared very well in the other's absence. Yet today, despite plenty of lip service on every ritual occasion to freedom of the press, radio, and TV, three very powerful forces are undermining that very freedom, damming the streams of public interest news that irrigate and nourish the flowering of self-determination. You've heard parts of these three issues addressed. The first is the centuries-old reluctance of governments, even elected governments, to operate in the sunshine of disclosure and criticism. The second is more subtle and more recent. It's the tendency of these mega media giants that we've been talking about tonight, operating on big business principles, to exalt commercial values over and above democratic values. That is, to run what Edward R. Murrow 45 years ago called broadcasting's money-making throttle machine at full throttle. In doing so, they squeeze the serious coverage of public affairs into ever-dwindling news holes. They squeeze out the journalism that tries to get as close as possible to the verifiable truth. And they are gobbling up small and independent outlets competing for the public's attention. If they can, they will become the gatekeepers of the Internet. And then this nascent movement, upon which depends upon that great public park of the Internet, will itself be brought to an end. Let me give you an example of what I mean when I say that democracy cannot function without an informed public. Only 13% of the eligible young people cast ballots in the last presidential election. A recent national survey revealed that only half of the 1,500 young people polled believe that voting is important. And only 46% think they can make a difference in solving community problems. We're talking here about one quarter of the American electorate. The Carnegie Corporation conducted a youth challenge quiz of 15 to 24-year-olds and asked them, why don't more young people get involved? Of the nearly 2,000 respondents, the main answer was that they did not have enough information about issues and candidates. Let me rewind and say it again. Democracy cannot exist without an informed public, and these mega media companies are not informing us. This is hardly a new or surprising story, but there are some very fresh and disturbing chapters. In earlier times, our governing bodies tried to squelch journalistic freedom with the blunt instruments of the law: padlocks for the presses and jail cells for outspoken editors and writers. Over time, with spectacular wartime exceptions, the courts and the Constitution struck those weapons out of their hands. But now they've found new ones in the name of national security. The classifier's top secret stamp, used indiscriminately, is as potent as a silencer as a writ of arrest. And beyond what is officially labeled secret, there hovers a culture of sealed official lips, open only to favored media insiders like Bob Novak, willing to do their bidding. We have a government of leak and innuendo and spin, of misnamed public information offices that churn out blizzards of releases filled with self-justifying exaggerations and occasionally just plain damned lies. Censorship without officially appointed censors. And you add to that censorship by omission of these consolidated media empires digesting the bones of swallowed independence, and you've got a major shrinkage of important independent information. People saw that coming a century ago with the rise of chain newspaper ownerships and then of the concentration in the very young radio industry. And then in the early, zesty, progressive days of the New Deal, the Federal Communications Act, which you've had referred to tonight, of 1934, was passed. I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. The aim of the cornerstone of that broadcast policy, mentioned over 100 times in its pages, was to promote the public interest, convenience, and necessity. The clear intent was to prevent a monopoly of commercial values over democratic values and to assure that the official view of reality, whether corporate or political, was not the only view of reality. Regulators and regulated media and government were encouraged to keep a wary eye on each other, to preserve those checks and balances that are the bulwark of our constitutional order. So, what would happen if the contending giants of big government and big publishing and big broadcasting ever joined hands, ever saw eye to eye in putting the public's need for news second to free market economics? That is exactly what is happening now under the banner of deregulation. Giant mega media conglomerates that our founders could not possibly have envisioned, finding common cause with the imperial state, a betrothal certain to produce more bastards and even fewer sons and daughters of liberty than the old arranged marriage of church and state. Consider where we are today. Never has there been an administration so disciplined at secrecy, so precisely in lockstep in keeping information from the people at large and in defiance of the Constitution from their representatives in Congress. Never have we had such a powerful media oligopoly. The term is Barry Diller's on my show, not mine. So unabashed in reaching like Caesar for still more wealth and power. Never have hand and glove fitted so comfortably to manipulate political debate, so contempt for the idea of government itself, and trivialize your need to know. When the journalist historian Richard Reeves, a friend of mine, was asked by a college student to define real news, he answered, "The news you and I need to keep our freedoms." When the press throws in with power, that is the first news marched by the censors to the guillotine. You know as well as I know that the greatest moments in the history of the press came not when journalists made common cause with the state, but when they stood fearlessly independent of it. Which brings me to the third powerful force. The first was secrecy in government. The second was the rise of the mega media corporations. The third powerful force that is shaping what you see, hear, and read is the quasi-official partisan press, ideologically linked to an authoritarian administration that is itself, in turn, the ally and agent of the most powerful economic interests in the world. This convergence of a right-wing partisan press with a right-wing administration dominates the political market of ideas today in a phenomenon unique in our history. You do not need to harbor the notion of a vast right-wing conspiracy to think that this convergence of interest is more than pure coincidence. Conspiracy is unnecessary when ideology hungers for power and its many diverse adherents swarm of their own accord to the same pot of honey. Stretching from the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal to the faux news of Rupert Murdoch's empire, to the nattering nabobs of know-nothing radio, to a legion of think tanks fronting for conglomerates, the religious, partisan, and corporate right have raised a mighty megaphone for sectarian, commercial, and political forces that aim to transform the democratic and egalitarian ideals embodied in our founding documents.
You're listening to Bill Moyers at the National Conference for Media Reform. We'll go back to his speech. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back to Bill Moyers in a minute.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
At ABC News, work at CNN. To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
Thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message. Managing the message.
Media Wars by Polarity One here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to Bill Moyers speaking in Madison, Wisconsin, host of the PBS program Now.
At the core of that agenda, as Tom Hartman summed it up in a recent essay on commondreams.org, is an agenda to transfer control of our government and our commons to big corporations, reduce taxes on the rich while squeezing the middle class, and privatize the environment while stripping working people of their power to organize and aggrandizing corporate power through political alliances and monopolistic mergers. With no strong opposition party to challenge such triumphalist hegemony, it is left to journalism to be democracy's best friend. That is why so many journalists, including myself, joined you in questioning Michael Powell's bid to permit further concentration of media ownership. If free and independent journalism is suffocated, the oxygen goes out of democracy. And there is no surer way to silence mainstream journalists than to be their boss. If you doubt it, read Jane Cramer's remarkable and chilling account in the current New Yorker of Silvio Berlusconi. The Prime Minister of Italy is its richest citizen and its first media mogul. The list of media that he or his relatives or his proxies own or directly or indirectly control includes the state television networks and radio stations, three of Italy's four commercial television networks, two big publishing houses, two national newspapers, 50 magazines, the country's largest movie production and distribution company, and a chunk of its internet services. Even as we speak, he is pressing the parliament for a law that would enable him to purchase even more media properties, including the most influential paper in the country. It is said in Jane Cramer's article that half the reporters in Italy work for Berlusconi, and the other half think they might have to. Small wonder that he has managed to put the Italian state to work to guarantee his fortune, or that his name is commonly attached to such unpleasant things as contempt for the law, conflict of interest, bribery, and money laundering. Yet, says Cramer, his power over what Italians see, read, buy, and above all think is overwhelming. The editor of The Economist, who was on Now with Bill Moyers 2 weeks ago, was asked recently why a British magazine was devoting so much space to an Italian prime minister, and Bill Emmett replied that Berlusconi had betrayed the two things the magazine stands for, capitalism and democracy. Could it happen here? You're damned right. It could happen here. By the way, Berlusconi's close friend is Rupert Murdoch. And this summer, programming on nearly all the satellite hookups in Italy was switched automatically to Murdoch's Sky Italia. So the issues bringing us here tonight are bigger and far more critical than simply media reform. That's why, before I go on, I want to ask you to look around. I'm serious. Just take a look to your left. Now take a look to your right. You're looking at your allies in one of the great ongoing struggles of the American experience, the struggle for the very soul of democracy, which I take to be government of, by, and for the people. It's a battle we can win if only we work together. And we saw that this year, as you've heard earlier this evening, when so many of you, 2 million of you, rallied to send your message to the FCC and the Congress. Journalistic coverage of independent of what was happening, the FCC was reserved, put off limits to everybody except the independent outlets, including PBS, which was the only broadcasting system that encouraged its journalists to report what was really happening. And let me tell you something. PBS is being made to punish. They're trying to make PBS pay for my sins of covering that. The right wing, the powerful media corporations, quietly behind the scenes, behind closed doors, intimidation and threats, warnings, you know, to lay off these subjects that the American people don't really care about. But because of our coverage and your activity and Edelstein and cops and the members of Congress you saw here today, this largely invisible issue burst out as a major political cause and ignited what I think is a crackling public debate, exposing Powell's failure to conduct an open discussion of the rule changes, save for a single hearing in Richmond, Virginia. I mean, all of these efforts led to a real participatory reform and brought it to center stage, where I actually believe it may even now become a catalyst for a new era of democratic small d renewal. I think we working journalists have something special to bring to this work. There's plenty of good talk here this weekend about the mechanics of reform, what laws are needed, what advocacy programs and strategies, how can we protect and extend the reach of those tools that give us some countervailing power against media monopoly instruments like the internet, cable TV, community-based radio, and public broadcasting systems, alternative journals of news and opinion. But let me tell you, without passion, without a message that has a beating heart, these won't be enough. And that's where a free press comes in. Journalism isn't the only bulwark of freedom, of course. It is, in fact, a deeply flawed craft practiced by deeply flawed humans. But at times it has risen to great occasions and made other freedoms possible. That's what the drafters of the First Amendment knew, and it's what we can't afford to forget. So to remind us of what our free press has been at its best and can be again. I may, in the next few minutes, call on the help of some unseen presences, men and women of journalism, often checkered but sometimes courageous past. Think with me for a moment on the reasons behind the establishment of press freedom. It wasn't ordained to protect hucksters, and it didn't drop like a gentle rain from heaven. It was fought and sacrificed for by unpretentious but feisty craftsmen who got their hands inky at their own hand presses and called themselves simply printers. The very first American newspaper was a little three-page affair put out in Boston in September of 1690. The editor was a man named Benjamin Harris, who said his mandate was to give an account of such considerable things as have come to my attention. Well, he didn't get much opportunity to do that because the government shut it down after one issue, just one issue, for the official reason that printer Ben Harris hadn't applied for the required government license to publish. But I wonder if some Massachusetts poobah didn't take personally one of Harris's proclaimed motives for starting the paper, which he said was, quote, to cure the spirit of lying, much among us. No one seems to have objected when Harris and his paper disappeared. That's the way things were. But some 40-odd years later, when printer John Peter Zinger was jailed in New York for criticizing its royal governor, things were different. The colony brought Zinger to trial on a charge of seditious libel. And since it didn't matter whether libel was true or not, the case seemed open and shut. But the jury ignored the judge's charge and freed Zinger, not only because the governor was widely disliked, but because of the closing appeal of Zinger's lawyer, Andrew Hamilton. Just hear him. Not the cause of the poor printer, nor of New York alone, but the cause of liberty. Every man who prefers freedom to a life of slavery will bless and honor you as men who, by an impartial and uncorrupt verdict, will have laid a noble foundation for securing to ourselves, our posterity, and our neighbors that to which nature and the laws of our country have given us a right, the liberty, both of exposing and opposing arbitrary power by speaking and writing the truth. I'd say that was still a pretty good mission statement. During the War for Independence itself, most of the three dozen little weekly newspapers in the colonies took the patriot side and mobilized resistance by giving space to anti-British letters, news of Parliament's latest outrages, and calls to action. But the clarion journalistic voice of the revolution was my hero, the one-time editor of the Pennsylvania magazine, Tom Paine, a penniless recent immigrant from England, where he left a trail of failure as a businessman and a husband. In 1776, just before enlisting in Washington's army, he published Common Sense, a hard-hitting pamphlet that slashed through the legalisms and doubts to make an uncompromising case for an independent and republican America. It's been called the first bestseller, with as many as 100,000 copies bought by a small literate population in the colonies. He followed it up with another convincing collection of essays written in the field and given another punchy title, The Crisis. Passed from hand to hand, reprinted in other papers, they spread the gospel of freedom to thousands of doubters. And why I bring Tom Paine up here in Madison, Wisconsin tonight is because he had something we've got to restore. He had a resolve to reach ordinary people with the message that they mattered and that they could stand up for themselves. He couched his gospel of human rights and equality in a popular style that any working writer can envy. As it is my design, he said, to make those that can scarcely read understand, I shall therefore avoid every literary ornament and put it in language as plain as the alphabet. That plain language spun off memorable one-liners that we're still quoting tonight. These are times that try men's souls. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Remember that. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. Virtue is not hereditary, even if your father was president. And I like this. I think of my father, fourth grade education, voted in every election, took it seriously, read the newspaper from front to cover, the little newspaper in Marshall, Texas. Of more worth, said Thomas Paine, is one honest man to society, he would say woman today, and in the sight of God, more worth than all the crowned ruffians that ever lived. I don't know what Paine would have thought of political debate by bumper sticker and soundbite, but he could have held his own as Studs Terkel's running mate. And of course, since they knew each other, there were also editors who felt responsible to audiences that would dive deep. I mean, this is unbelievable. In 1787 and 88, the little New York Independent Advertiser ran all 85 members of the Federalist, numbers of the Federalist, those serious essays in favor of ratifying the Constitution. They still shine as clear arguments, but they are and they were unforgiving in their demand for concentrated attention. Nevertheless, the Advertiser felt that it owed the best to its readers. It trusted its readers, and they trusted him. And the readers knew that the issues of self-government deserved their best attention in return. I pray that our media reform movement includes the press as conscientious as the New York Advertiser, as pungent as common sense, and as public-spirited and resolute as both. It will take it, because remember, what the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Back in 1791, when the First Amendment was ratified, the idea of a free press seemed safely sheltered in law, but it wasn't. Only 7 years later, in the midst of a war scare with France, Congress passed and John Adams signed the infamous Sedition Act. The act made it a crime. The act made it a crime to circulate opinions, quote, tending to induce a belief that lawmakers might have constitutional or repressive motives, or, quote, directly or indirectly tending to justify France or to criminate, whatever that meant, the president or other federal officials. No wonder opponents called it a scheme to excite a fervor against foreign aggression only to establish tyranny at home. John Ashcroft would have loved it. But let me tell you what happened. A dozen editors refused to be frightened and went defiantly to prison, some under state prosecution. One of them, Matthew Lyon, who also held a seat in the House of Representatives, languished for 4 months in an unheated cell during a Vermont winter. But admirers chipped in to pay his $1,000 fine, and when he emerged, his district reelected him by a landslide. Such was the spirit of liberty abroad in the land at the time. Luckily, The Sedition Act had a built-in expiration act date of 1801, at which time President Jefferson, who hated it from the first, pardoned those remaining under indictment. So that story has an upbeat ending, as ours may well have. But it will, let me be honest with you, it will take the kind of courage that those early printers and their readers showed.
You're listening to Bill Moyers, a host of the PBS program Now. We'll come back to him in a minute. You can get a copy of today's program by calling 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Back in a minute.
Trying to turn politics and the serious issues of our life into entertainment.
Managing the message.
Thank you, sir.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
In wartime, seeing is not always believing.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Mr. Secretary. Mr. Secretary.
To follow up on James' question a little bit.
I thought I answered that.
Media war.
The outcome is assured.
Media Wars, Polarity One, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we return to Bill Moyers.
Courage is a timeless quality and surfaces when the government is tempted to hit the bottle of censorship again during national emergencies, real or manufactured. As so many of you will recall, in 1971, during the Vietnam War, the Nixon administration resurrected the doctrine of prior restraint from the crypt and tried to ban the publication of the Pentagon Papers by the New York Times and the Washington Post, even though the documents themselves were a classified history of events during four earlier presidencies. Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the Times, and Katharine Graham, the publisher of the Post, were both warned by their lawyers that they and their top managers could face criminal prosecution under espionage laws if they printed the material that Daniel Ellsberg had leaked. And by the way, which Ellsberg offered to the three major television networks without success. But after internal debates and the threats of some of their best-known editors to resign rather than fold under pressure, including Ben Bagdikian, who is here this weekend, both owners gave the green light and were vindicated by the Supreme Court. Score another round for democracy. Bipartisan fairness, however, requires me to note that the Carter administration in 1979 tried to prevent the Progressive magazine, published right here in Madison, from running an article called How to Make an H-Bomb. The grounds were a supposed threat to, quote, national security. But Howard Moreland had compiled the piece entirely from sources open to the public, mainly to show that much of the classification system was Wizard of Oz smoke and mirrors. I remember when I was in the White House with Lyndon Johnson, we asked for the Pentagon to send us over the stories about Vietnam from the previous month. They came over, all right, by messenger in a truck, big packages of newspaper clippings wrapped in brown paper marked, stamped, top secret. But in the case of the Progressive, the courts again rejected the government's claim. And it's noteworthy that the journalism of defiance by that time had retreated to a small left-wing publication like the Progressive. In all three of those cases, confronted with a clear and present danger of punishment, none of the owners flinched. Could you name one executive of today's big media conglomerates likely to show the kind of resistance that Sulzberger, Graham, and Irwin Knoll did? Not Robert Wright of General Electric, He took Phil Donahue off NBC because the network didn't want to offend conservatives in Washington. Then MSNBC gave a show to Michael Savage, whose diatribes had described non-white countries as third world nations and gay men and women as part of the grand plan to cut down on the white race. Now, this is what struck me as odd. The GE NBC team had to calculate that while Donahue was offensive to conservatives, Savage wasn't. Not Michael Eisner. He told NPR he didn't even want ABC News, which Disney had bought, reporting on its parent, Disney. And certainly not Leslie Moonves, the head of CBS. In the very week that CBS was celebrating its 75th anniversary, taking kudos for its glory days as the Tiffany Network, unafraid to broadcast the harvest of shame and the selling of the Pentagon, the network's famous eye blinked. Pressured, as Congresswoman Slaughter said, by a vociferous and relentless right-wing campaign and by the Republican National Committee. You should read that letter that the RNC sent to CBS. And at a time when its parent Viacom has billions of dollars resting on whether the White House, Congress, and the FCC will allow it to own even more stations, CBS caved in and pulled the miniseries about Ronald Reagan that conservatives thought insufficiently worshipful. Granted, made-for-television movies about living figures are about as vital as the wax figures at Madame Tussauds and even less authentic. Granted that the canonizers of Ronald Reagan hadn't even seen the film before they set to howling. Granted, on the surface, it's a silly tempest in a teapot. Still, when a once great network falls obsequiously to the ground at the feet of a partisan mob over a cheesy miniseries no one would have taken seriously, you have to wonder if the slight tremor that just ran through the First Amendment might be the precursor of greater earthquakes to come when the stakes are really high. And what concessions do they make that we don't know about? So, what must we devise to make this media safer for individuals stubborn about protecting freedom and serving the truth? And what do we all, educators, administrators, legislators, and agitators, need to do to restore the disappearing diversity of media opinions? America had plenty of that in the early days, and I talk about it in the speech. But the hour is late, and I'm going to see that this speech gets published in its entirety so that we can get to the music. I just want to say a word about owners. We need owners like Joseph Pulitzer. When the one-time immigrant reporter for a German-language paper in St. Louis took over the New York World in 1883, he was already a millionaire in the making. But here's his recommended short platform for politicians. This was the agenda of the paper. 1, tax luxuries. 2, tax inheritances. 3, tax large incomes. 4, tax monopolies. 5, tax the privileged corporation. 6, a tariff for revenue. 7, reform the civil service. 9, corrupt officers. 9, punish vote buying. 10, punish employers who coerce their employees in elections. Can you imagine any of the media conglomerates publishing that as their agenda? The World certainly gave people plenty of the spice they wanted, entertainment, sensation, earthy advice on living, but not at the expense of news that let them know who was on their side against the boodlers and the bosses. Nor did big time, big bucks, big town journalism extinguish the possibility of a reform-minded investigative journalism that took the name of muckraking during the progressive era. Those days of early last century saw a second great awakening of the democratic impulse. What brought it into being was a reaction against the social Darwinism and the unrestrained capitalist exploitation that is back in full force today as the policy of the United States government. Certain popular magazines made space for and profited by the work of such journalists, to name only a few: Lincoln Steffens, Ida Tarbell, Upton Sinclair, Samuel Hopkins Adams, and David Graham Phillips. They ripped the veils from, among other things, the shame of the cities, the crimes of the trusts, the treason of the Senate, and the villainies of those who sold tainted meat and poisonous medicines. And why were they given those opportunities? Because, in the words of Samuel McClure, the owner of McClure's magazine, when special interests defy the law and flout the general welfare, there is a social debt incurred. And as he put it, we have to pay in the end, every one of us, and in the end, the sum total of the debt will be our liberty. Can you imagine Eisner, Moonves, Wright, or Murdoch saying that today? No! I have a lot more to say, but the hour is late, and I will publish this on the internet. I'm going to skip my policy recommendations and let you deal with those tomorrow. No, I do want to say a final word about my fellow journalists. You know, we need journalists who come out with a strong sense of public service, graduates who are perhaps a little more hard-boiled and street smart than the present crop, although that's hard to teach. Thanks to the high cost of education, we get very few recruits from the ranks of those who do the world's unglamorous and low-paid work. But I was a one-time cub in a very small town in East Texas, and I cherish what H.L. Mencken said about being a young Baltimore reporter 100 years ago. I was at large, he wrote, in a wicked seaport of 500,000 people with a front seat at every public show. By all orthodox cultural standards, I probably reached my all-time low, for the heavy reading of my teens had been abandoned in favor of life itself. But it would be an exaggeration to say I was ignorant, for if I neglected the humanities, I was meanwhile laying in all the worldly wisdom of a police lieutenant, a bartender, a shyster lawyer, or a midwife. We need that kind of human touch in our newsrooms today. And as for those professional association of editors, they might remember that in union there is strength. One journalist alone can't extract from an employer a commitment to let editors and not accountants choose the appropriate subject matter for coverage. But what if news councils blew the whistle on shoddy or cowardly management? What if foundations gave magazines like Fair and the Columbia Journalism Review the resources to spread their stories of journalistic bias, failure, or incompetence? What if entire editorial departments simply refused any longer to quote anonymous sources or give Kobe Bryant's trial more than the minimal space it rakes? Or to run stories planted by the Defense Department and impossible for alleged security reasons to verify? What if a professional association backed them to the hilt or required the same stance from all its members? It would take courage to confront powerful ownership that way, but not as much courage as is asked of those journalists in some countries who face the dungeon, the executioner, and the secret assassin for speaking out. All of this may be in the domain of fantasy, what I wish for, and then again, maybe not. What I know to be real is that we are in for the fight of our lives. While I am not a romantic about democracy or journalism, I believe Andre Gide was onto something when he said that all things human given time go badly, which is why the First Amendment is the most important part of our democratic society, because it means we can get up on the deck of the ship and grab the captain by the elbow and say, "That's an iceberg out there." I'm not a romantic about democracy or journalism, but I know this. Democracy and journalism are deeply linked in whatever chance we human beings have to redress our grievances, renew our politics, and reclaim our revolutionary ideals. Those are difficult tasks at any time. They are more difficult in a cynical age like this, when a deep and pervasive corruption has settled upon the American Republic. But too much is at stake for our spirits to flag. Earlier this week, the Library of Congress gave the first Kluge Lifetime Award in the Humanities to the Polish philosopher Leszek Kolakowski. To an interviewer, he said, "There is one freedom on which all other liberties depend, and that is freedom of expression, freedom of speech, of print. If this is taken away, no other freedom can exist, or at least it would soon be suppressed." I'm older than almost all of you in this fight, and am not likely to be around for the duration. But I take heart from the presence in this room tonight, unseen, of Peter Singer, Thomas Paine, the Muckrakers, I.F. Stone, all those heroes and heroines, celebrated or forgotten, who faced odds no less than ours and did not flinch. I take heart from your presence here. It's your fight now. Look around. You're not alone.
Bill Moyers, host of the PBS program Now, and he's also the founding director of Public Affairs Television, speaking at the National Conference on Media Reform in Madison, Wisconsin. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a video copy of the program or audio, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. And you can also sign up for our daily digest there that brings you news and information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Purvesh Sharma. Mike DeFilippo and Rich Kim are our engineers. Angela Alston, our director. Again, if you'd like a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.